This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the Buick Enclave, the finest luxury crossover ever. Visit buick.gm.ca to see that where there's passion, there's beauty.
This is Special Delivery, a podcast where short-run series from CBC Radio get a second chance at fame and you get a second chance to listen. I'm Sharon Farrell. The 2007 Massey Lectures are coming up, and the series is called City of Words with best-selling author Alberto Mangel. You can hear it on the CBC Radio 1 program Ideas throughout the week of November the 5th. As a special treat to whet your Massey appetite, we're taking a look back at five of our most memorable Massey Lectures. This week, the opening lecture from urbanist, writer, and activist Jane Jacobs. Said to be an intellectual warrior, her series was called Canadian Cities and Sovereignty Association. She presented it in 1979.
When Jane Jacobs' classic book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities, was published in 1961, William H. White, author of The Organization Man, called it, quote, one of the most remarkable books ever written about the city. Planners may dispute the conclusions, White said, but they're going to have to think about them. They did. So did many politicians and community leaders around the world. The physical planning and sociological success of Toronto today largely bear out Jane Jacobs' theories of how cities can and should work. With the publication of her book, The Economy of Cities, in 1969, just after she had moved from New York to Toronto, where she now lives as a Canadian citizen, Jane Jacobs' place among important contemporary social theorists was assured. Here's Jane Jacobs with the first of the 1979 Massey Lectures.
The other day, I asked a bright young electronics engineer from the West, born and now living in British Columbia, brought up in Alberta, what he thought would happen in the forthcoming Quebec referendum. It's a question I often ask. In reply, what I usually get is a statement, either indifferent or impassioned, of how the person I'm addressing feels about Quebec separatism. But this time I got a flat, forthright prediction. They'll vote no, he said. Why are you so sure? I asked. Because, he answered, nothing really interesting ever happens in Canada. Now, I myself have no idea how the referendum will turn out, so I'm not going to speculate about that. But I agree with my young friend that sovereignty association is an interesting possibility. In this talk, I'm going to speak of the feelings people have about separatism and discuss the reasons why sovereignty association has risen as an issue at this time. Next week, I plan to describe how Norway and Sweden contended with separatism. And I'll follow that with a discussion of the size of nations. Then I'll get into the subject of sovereignty association itself. As an idea, sovereignty association can mean two very different things. It can mean new arrangements among already existing nations, as in the case of the European Economic Community, or the younger five-member Andean Community in South America. On the other hand, it might also mean new arrangements among parts of already existing nations, as has been tentatively suggested by some European separatists, and as René Lévesque is proposing. That second version of the idea forces us not only to think about sovereignty association itself, but also to confront the idea of separation or secession. It's hard even to think about separations because the subject is so charged with emotion. Sometimes people literally acknowledge this when they say, it's unthinkable. Nationalistic emotions are dangerous, of course. They've helped fuel many a war, many an act of terrorism, many a tyranny. But they are valuable emotions, too. One thing they mean is that we're profoundly attached to the communities of which we are part, and this attachment includes, for most of us, our nations. We care how our nations fare, care on a level deeper by far than concern with what is happening to the gross national product, our sheer feelings of who we are twine with feelings about our nations, so that when we feel proud of our nations, we somehow feel personally proud. When we feel ashamed of our nations, or sorrow for them, the shame or the sorrow hits home. These emotions are felt deeply by separatists and equally deeply by those who ardently oppose separatists. The conflicts are not between different kinds of emotions. They are conflicts, rather, between different ways of identifying the nation, different choices as to what the nation is. For Quebec separatists, the nation is Quebec. For their opponents, either inside the province or outside it, the nation is Canada, defined as including Quebec. Trying to argue about these feelings is as fruitless as trying to argue that people in love ought not to be in love, or if they must be, then they should be cold and hard-headed about choosing their attachments. It doesn't work that way. We feel. The feelings are their own argument. The irrationality of all this shows up in universal patterns of inconsistency. De Gaulle, who said, "Vive le Québec libre," never said, "Long live a free Brittany," or "Vive la Provence libre." He could feel for separatists abroad, but not for separatists at home. This pattern is perfectly ordinary, perhaps always has been. The same Englishman who ardently favored Greek independence from Turkish rule in the 19th century did not, therefore, also campaign for Irish independence from English rule. Rationally, the one would certainly follow from the other. Emotionally, no. British support of Pakistani separatists at the time when India became independent did not imply any comfort or support for Scottish nationalists. Just so, many a Canadian who opposes Quebec separatism was sympathetic to the unsuccessful Biafran secession movement in Nigeria. I know some of those people. The same Canadians who can argue eloquently that justice and good sense both are on the side of Estonian, Latvian, Lithuanian, Walloon, Kurdish, or Palestinian separatists can maintain that Quebec separatists must be out of their minds to want something so impractical and destructive. Separatists are quite as rationally inconsistent themselves. If and when they win their way, they always promptly forget their championship of self-determination and oppose any further separation at home. The colonies that became the United States declared their independence on the grounds that their grievances made it, quote, necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them. It's often been remarked how inconsistent this is with the war waged by the northern states against the secessionist Confederate states some 67 years later. Today's newly independent nations are one and all against their own separatists or potential separatists. As one student of government has put it, leaders of these new regimes are desperately concerned to argue that self-determination can be employed once in the process of securing independence, but that it cannot be resorted to subsequently. Finland, after having achieved independence from Russia, promptly refused the right of self-determination to the population of the Åland Islands. They were ethnically Swedish and sought to break away from Finland with the object of joining Sweden. Pakistan, having won its own separation, then went on to fight the separation of East Pakistan, now Bangladesh, and so on. We can be sure that if Quebec negotiates a separation, it will oppose adamantly, whether then or thereafter, any separations from Quebec. That's the way all nations behave, no matter how old or young, how powerful or weak, how developed or undeveloped, or how they themselves came into being. These emotions, of course, are always being presented as reasoned and reasonable, but that doesn't always stand up to inspection. Take, for instance, the word balkanization. Spoken with the ring of authority, balkanization can be made to sound like a compressed history lesson proving the folly of small sovereignties. But what about the Balkans, really? Before they became small and separate sovereignties after the First World War, they had been portions of very large sovereignties indeed, the Turkish and Austro-Hungarian empires. As portions of large sovereignties, they had lain poor, backward, and stagnant for centuries. That's how they happened to be poor and backward when at last they became independent. If a fate called Balkanization means anything reasoned at all, it has to mean that the Balkans were somehow made to be poor, backward, and generally unfortunate by having been cut up small. But that's simply untrue. Or else it has to mean that if Romania, Bulgaria, Yugoslavia, and Albania had been joined together in one nation after the Great War, or perhaps had been united with Greece to form a still larger nation, they would be better off now. Who knows? In the nature of the thing, there's no evidence either to support such a conclusion or contradict it. Consider a scholarly and rational-sounding prediction like this one for Canada, if Quebec should separate. Quote, deprived of real authority or purpose, the federal state would simply disintegrate like the Austro-Hungarian Empire in 1918. That appears in a new book by a professor of political science at the University of Alberta. The trouble with his analogy is that the Austro-Hungarian Empire did not disintegrate because a successful separatist movement occurred there. It had its separatists, especially in the Balkans, some of whom were violent, but the movements were kept in check. The empire was defeated in a great war, and as it lay in chaos, it was deliberately dismembered by the conquerors. The analogy to Canada is so far-fetched historically and so specious factually that we can only understand it as an emotional cry of anguish, not a true account of how things are in this country. To understand why sovereignty association has become a serious issue in Canada at this time, we must look at two cities, Montreal and Toronto. They're responsible for what's been happening in Quebec. Between them, they have converted a province into something more nearly resembling a new nation. Nobody planned this outcome. Nobody even recognized what was happening at the time it happened. The events that worked this transformation don't go very far back. We can date them statistically as having begun in 1941, but that is simply because 41 was a census year. I suspect they actually began in 1939 with the war economy. Let's begin with the part played by Montreal. Between 1941 and 1971, Montreal grew enormously. In those 30 years, the city more than doubled its population, increasing from a little more than 1 million persons to more than 2 million. These were the years that led up to and included the Quiet Revolution, the turning point in modern Quebec history, when French Quebec culture came out of its shell, welcomed change instead of resisting it, and moved into the modern world. The 1960s were the decade of the Quiet Revolution. Immigrants from other countries contributed to Montreal's growth between 1941 and 1971. So did people from other parts of Canada, and of course some were born there. But the major influx of population was from rural and small-town Quebec itself. Previously, rural Quebecois had migrated into Montreal, of course, just as they migrated into Quebec City and to New England. But nothing in the past resembled this migration. It dwarfed previous rural-to-city movements within the province. Furthermore, the rapidity with which the movement happened, as well as the absolute numbers of people involved, was unprecedented. These French-speaking migrants into Montreal spent the 1940s and 1950s finding each other. The quiet revolution of the 1960s was then built on their networks of new interests and relationships in the arts, in politics, working life, and education. French culture in Montreal was in a quiet ferment as people built these relationships and put together ambitions and ideas they couldn't have developed even in a smaller city like the capital, Quebec City. In the 1960s, the evidence of this ferment burst forth in French theater, music, films. Talent and audiences had now found each other. There was a new and rapidly growing readership for Quebec books and periodicals. Writers and readers had found each other. At about the same time, for a combination of reasons, new kinds of opportunities finally began opening up to Quebecois and city professions and commerce. The most important of those reasons was the economic growth of Montreal. Until the early 1960s, Montreal still seemed to be what it had been, an English city with many French-speaking workers and inhabitants. But now, because of the growth and the accompanying cultural processes I've just described, Montreal had become a French-Canadian city with many English-speaking inhabitants. By the time people in Montreal, let alone the rest of Canada, recognized what had been happening, it had already happened. Out in rural Quebec, the old stronghold of French culture, another kind of quiet revolution was taking place. From farming villages, fishing villages, market towns, and mill towns, hundreds of thousands of people, especially young people, were trickling and then pouring into Montreal. As the stream swelled, it had its effects on education and aspirations. But life also changed for many of the people who stayed put in rural Quebec. A million extra city people eat a lot. And even though many of these extra city people had previously been eating on farms right there in Quebec, feeding them now involved city trade and city money. With this growing city market, and so many young people leaving the villages too, equipment to improve rural productivity, tractors, trucks, piped water, electrical appliances, began showing up in places where in the past there would have been neither money to buy them nor much reason to need them. All these changes had a profound effect on religious life in Quebec. Contrary to what most people believe, the Quebec religious revolution, meaning loss of authority by the Catholic Church, was not a cause of the city and rural changes I have mentioned, but a result of them. The local priest's word about the world and its ways was no longer the last word in settlements where almost everyone was now at least distantly acquainted with somebody who had been off to a Montreal university for a secular education. Or in settlements where people now went to the movies when they got into town. Or in settlements where changes in the everyday economy and everyday working methods had burst out of the bounds of traditional ways of doing things. One and the same force, the great growth surge of Montreal, was simultaneously undermining the old culture in the countryside, developing it into something new in the metropolis, and sending this new city-shaped culture back into the countryside. Now we need to bring Toronto into the story. Montreal used to be the chief metropolis, the national economic center of all of Canada. It's an older city than Toronto, and until only a few years ago was larger. At the beginning of this century, Toronto was only two-thirds the size of Montreal, and Montreal was much the more important center of finance, publishing, wholesaling, retailing, manufacturing, entertainment, everything that goes into making a city economy. The first small and tentative shifts of national finance from Montreal to Toronto began in the 1920s when Montreal banks overlooked the financing of new mining opportunities which were then opening up in Ontario. That neglect created an opportunity for Toronto banks. A stock exchange set up in Toronto for trading mining shares then merged with the old General Toronto Stock Exchange in 1934, and by the 1940s, the volume of stocks traded in Toronto exceeded that in Montreal. During the great growth surge of Montreal from 1941 to 1971, Toronto grew at a rate that was even faster. In the first of those decades, when Montreal was growing by about 20%, Toronto was growing by a rate closer to 25%. In the next decade, from 1951 to 61, when Montreal was adding a bit over 35% to its population, Toronto was adding about 45%. And from 1961 to 71, while Montreal was growing by less than 20%, Toronto was growing by 30%. The result was that Toronto finally overtook Montreal in the late 1970s. However, even these measurements are deceptive as measurements of what was happening economically. Thought of as an economic unit or economic force, Toronto has in fact been a great deal larger than Montreal for many years. This is because Toronto forms the center of a collection of satellite cities and towns in addition to its suburbs. Those satellites contain a great range of economic activities, from steel mills to art galleries. Like many of the world's large metropolises, Toronto has been spilling out enterprises into its nearby region, causing many old and formerly small towns and little cities to grow. In addition to that, many enterprises that needed a metropolitan market and a reservoir of metropolitan skills and other producers to draw upon have established themselves in Toronto's orbit, but in places where costs are lower or space more easily available. The English call a collection of cities and towns with this kind of economic integration a conurbation, a term now widely adopted. Toronto's conurbation, curving around the western end of Lake Ontario, has been nicknamed the Golden Horseshoe. Hamilton, which is in the horseshoe, is larger than Calgary. Georgetown, north of Toronto, qualifies as only a small Ontario town, one of many such in the conurbation. In New Brunswick, it would be a major economic settlement. The economic growth of Montreal, on the other hand, was not large enough to help create a conurbation. Montreal's growth contained itself within the city and its suburbs. That's why it's deceptive to compare population sizes of the two cities, and jump to the conclusion that not until the 1970s had they become more or less equal in economic terms. Toronto supplanted Montreal as Canada's chief economic center considerably before that, probably even before 1960. Whenever it did happen, it was another of those things that most of us never realized had happened until considerably afterward. Because Toronto was growing more rapidly than Montreal in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, and because so many of its institutions and enterprises now served the entire country, Toronto not only drew people from many other countries, but from across Canada, too. The first 2 weeks I lived here, back in the late 1960s, it seemed to me that almost everyone I encountered was a migrant from Winnipeg or New Brunswick. Had Montreal remained Canada's preeminent metropolis and national center, many of these Canadians would have been migrating to Montreal instead. In that case, Montreal would not only be even larger than it is today, but, and this is important, it would have remained an English-Canadian metropolis. Instead, it has become more and more distinctively Quebecois. In sum, then, these two things were occurring at once. On the one hand, Montreal's growth in the decades 1941-1971 shook up much of rural Quebec and transformed Quebec's culture, too. On the other hand, Toronto and the Golden Horseshoe were growing even more rapidly. Montreal, in spite of its growth, was losing its character as the economic center of an English-speaking Canada, and was simultaneously taking on its character as a regional, French-speaking metropolis. These events, I think, are at the core of Quebec's changed and changing relationship with the rest of Canada. Things can never go back to the way they were when an English-speaking Montreal was the chief economic center of all of Canada and when life elsewhere in the province was isolated and traditional. These changes are not merely in people's heads. They cannot be reasoned away or even voted away. Nor are these changes merely intensifications or extensions of the old French-Canadian grievances. A culture can persist without its own metropolitan capital, as Quebec's did for so long, but it cannot flower and thrive without one. Quebec does have its own cultural metropolis now. But Montreal, to continue thriving as a cultural capital, must also thrive economically. Yet, as a regional Canadian city, Montreal's economic future is unpromising. To understand why this is so, we must be aware of Canada's customary view of economic life and its traditional approach to economic development. The Canadian approach emphasizes exploitation and export of resources to the neglect of industry and services based on manufacturing. The experience of Canada has been that the largest and most quickly obtained fortunes, whether public or private, come from resources. Furs, timber, apples, coal, iron, nickel, gold, silver, grain, cobalt, fish, uranium, hydroelectric power, oil, to name some of the most influential. Societies, like individuals, are shaped by their experiences. Canada's get-rich-quick experiences with resources have helped mold the nature of all the country's major institutions. The national government, the provincial governments, the banks, and other financial establishments. Those experiences have shaped the way venture capital is used, the way subsidies are used, the kinds of development schemes considered attractive, and the thinking of almost everyone in authority. These are not easy things to change. When one dominant approach to economic life and wealth has been pursued as consistently as it has been here, and for as long as it has been here, the experience gets thoroughly built into the works. It especially gets built into the uses of capital. Dazzling sums of money are available for resource exploitation and for a few other schemes, usually of grandiose proportions. Although there are some exceptions, especially in Toronto, almost no capital goes into development of many, many small, humdrum, and humble kinds of city work. It's this kind of work, taken all together, that builds up creative city economies and, along with them, an industrially and commercially strong national economy. Canada's regional cities have their traditional role. By default of other functions, they work primarily as service centers for the exploitation of resources from their hinterlands. To be sure, all have some manufacturing, even the small ones like Halifax, St. John's, Thunder Bay, and Saskatoon, as well as the larger ones like Winnipeg, Calgary, Edmonton, and the largest, Vancouver. But large or small, they have not served, at least so far, as creative economic centers in their own rights, creating new kinds of exports and replacing imports. That is why so many Canadian inventors and creative entrepreneurs must traditionally leave Canada for other countries to put their ideas to use. Or if they do manage to get started here, must then typically sell their enterprises to American companies to get capital for development and expansion. That is also why Canada, taken as a whole, has developed so little manufacturing, and why so much of what it does have, even in Toronto and the Golden Horseshoe, is undertaken in branch plants spun off from other countries, especially the United States. That is also why Canadian regional cities boom while the exploitation of their hinterlands is booming, as is happening in Alberta now, but then characteristically stagnate when the resource exploitation reaches a plateau. We have now a difficulty unprecedented in Canada. We have never before had a national city which lost that position and became a regional city. We have one now. Montreal cannot sustain the economy it has had in the past or retain its many other unusual assets if it subsides into becoming a typical Canadian regional city. If that is all Montreal does, it will stagnate economically and probably culturally too. In short, Montreal cannot afford to act like other uncreative Canadian regional cities. It must be the kind of place in which enterprises can develop new, innovative city-made products and services and can take to producing locally wide ranges of former imports and can find capital to help this happen. If Montreal cannot be that sort of place, it will be in grave and gathering trouble. The chances are small that Montreal will be able to transcend the usual inertia of the regional cities if Quebec remains a province of Canada. As Montreal's troubles deepen, Quebecois are certainly going to believe they would do better by taking their economy into their own hands. They might not do better, of course. They themselves might cling to the traditional Canadian approach to economic life and neglect other possibilities. But the point is, Quebec is now headed for trouble because of Montreal's new situation, and the traditional Canadian approach is not going to help. Inevitably, whether or not they would do better on their own, the Quebecois are going to think they could. Perhaps they even might. This is why the issue of sovereignty association, now that it has been raised, is not going to evaporate. The changes underlying that issue are irreversible, and they are not going to evaporate. Until the issue is somehow resolved, it is going to be raised again and again and again. In one guise or another, it will go on and on and on. Thus, it seems to me that we'd better think about it, emotionally painful though that may be. We're not the first people to find ourselves beset by the nagging of separatists. Next week, I'm going to go back 70 years and describe a situation like ours and how it was resolved peacefully.
Canadian Cities and Sovereignty Association by Jane Jacobs. The first of the 1979 Massey Lectures.
You may also enjoy reading the entire lecture series in a new book called The Lost Massey Lectures, Recovered Classics from Five Great Thinkers. For more information on the book, go to the CBC Radio Literary website, Words at Large, at cbc.ca/wordsatlarge. In the coming weeks, we'll give you more samples of the Lost Massey Lectures. Next Friday, hear Professor John Kenneth Galbraith of the Harvard School of Economics with his opening lecture from 1965. I'm Sharon Farrell. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Nora Young, the host of Spark on CBC Radio. What is Spark, you ask? Well, Spark is...
Spark is online.
Spark is interactive.
Spark is a conversation.
Spark is digital.
Spark is a new kind of radio show.
You can check out the Spark blog, contribute to the show, and download the podcast at cbc.ca/spark.